ladies and gentlemen.
This is it.
You expected a mystery.
Get your hand off of that.
You expected a puzzle. But for one person on this island, this is not a game.
Will you explain it to us then, Detective?
Holy
Really, Duke?
Oh my God!
Really?
Lock the doors. Stay in your rooms.
Everyone
is in danger.
All right. When's the murder mystery start?
Hello, dear listeners. Welcome back to the James Bond Complex, the podcast in which we discuss, analyze, rejoice with a fine-tooth comb the James Bond phenomenon from Fleming to film and everything in between. I'm one of your co-hosts, Jason Kim, and we heard another echo. Who do we have?
That echo came from me, Edgar.
And Edgar, what are we doing? What are we going to discuss today to kick off the year 2023?
Well, we're completing, as a collective, the four of us at the James Bond Complex, for completing our duology of the Benoit Blanc saga. The tears, the laughs, the mysteries, the murders, the puzzle pieces. We are doing Glass Onion, which I believe officially known as Glass Onion : A Knives Out Mystery. That is the official title of this thing.
Yes, it is.
Directed by Rian Johnson, written by Rian Johnson, starring Daniel Craig, once again as Benoit Blanc, and good Lord, Edward Norton, Janelle Monáe, Catherine Hahn, Leslie Odom Jr., Kate Hudson, Dave Bautista, who Daniel Craig knows well, Jessica Henwick, Madeline Klein, and some fun faces I'm sure we can get into as the review goes along. Jason, let's start macro and go micro.
Okay.
How many times have you seen the movie so far?
I've seen it three times.
Three times. Are you getting tired of it?
No, I'm seeing this like the way I see Casino Royale, Star Wars A New Hope, and Inception. The more I watch it, the more I learn something from the movie, and the more I like it.
Are you telling me that it's almost like you're peeling back the onion layers and
I'm peeling back the onion layers, and then the center of it all is just hidden, or it's not even hiding in plain sight.
It's right in front of us. Now, Jason, I know that, you know, you get very excited when you come on the show, especially when it's a Daniel Craig topic, almost irrespective. It feels like I'm always doing the Daniel Craig topics with you, except maybe Emery, who did Knives Out, but it's usually me and you. But I need you to be professional. I need you to buttress your feelings about Daniel Craig. Buttress them. Were you able to buttress your feelings at the time of this recording, let's say, at the time of this release, I guess a couple of weeks ago, you once again were in the presence of Daniel Craig for the second time in a couple of months?
Oh, yes, I was. I saw Daniel Craig three times in the year of 2022, or five times total over the course of 14 months, because I attended a podcast recording with him at Leicester Square, or podcast evening talk with him at Leicester Square a few days before the premiere, saw him at the premiere of No Time to Die, that is. Mm-hmm. Watched him on Macbeth late March, early April of 2022. Went to a film closing of the Montclair Film Festival interview with him and Stephen Colbert. And then Matt Spazer informed the Bond community before the tickets went on sale of a Knives Out talk with the MTV and Comedy Central podcast host named Josh Horowitz. I never heard of him before that event or seen him before, but like, you know, I followed his channel afterwards. And then for our listeners, Matt Spazer of Suits of Bond, he actually works at the venue that I attended this Knives Out event with. with me, Kyle, Barbara, Easy Smiles, Expensive Watches, Boomer, his girlfriend Sarah Spillane. Those were the only Bond community in presence at the time. So it was almost our same Macbeth watching group, but with few missing this time.
But it sounds like you guys had a good time having met Spacer and at least Spacer and Barbeau once in person. They're very, very fine people, and Barbeau even helped us with a beer episode that came out about a year ago. So he's a good player. He's a good trooper.
So because I was able to get the tickets before they went on sale, because I was able to get the tickets for very good, extremely cheap or cheaper price than what it was. I don't know what the public sale prices were, but I got it at a very discounted rate. And as a result, I invited my friend Stephanie, who I used to know when she and I used to live in Atlanta. She lives in Hudson Yards, New York. I invited her, and then I brought my two Georgia Tech Atlanta friends. So this was a good. So I kind of went the James Davis, what James Davis did for me. Like, I spread the James Bond fandom well to my friends.
That is, it's the spirit of giving, after all. It's the holiday season, and the event did take place just at the start of the holiday season. So it made sense, you know, it was fitting. So I think we have a lot to talk about. Now, even at the time this episode comes out, you know, the movie has not been on Netflix for very long. I think you and I do want to get into plot details. That's part of the fun of, you know, peeling back the onion layers. But how about we start, if only for a few minutes, and, you know, I'll include a little spoiler warning in post when we get to the details, but maybe just a couple of minutes, a drive-by generic review of Glass Onion, A Knives Out and Mystery. What are your sentiments about this sequel? Yay, nay, somewhere in between?
Oh, super yay, super, super duper yay. I think Rian Johnson's a brilliant, brilliant writer, and he needs to continue just doing these creative original pieces. He never needs to enter the franchise realm, because, like, clearly Last Jedi was a more polarizing movie. Last Jedi was much more polarizing than, say, the Two Knives Out movie or Looper or Brothers Bloom back then. Those are more universally praised, and he needs to stick to his lane, I think.
Yeah, well, I guess the irony now at this point with two Knives Out films under his belt, he doesn't need to step into any other franchise. He's now created his own franchise, albeit on a smaller budget, but still it's his own franchise. Yeah, it's funny how those things work out. You know, a director, writer, director, he, she, they earn praise. They earn maybe festival circuit notoriety, Indie Spirit Awards and this and that. And then Hollywood comes calling, offers them a significantly larger budget, probably significantly larger salary as well. And, you know, shit happens, whether it's their fault or their own. And sometimes you just have to draw the conclusion, a bit like you alluded to, you know, that their talent, I don't want to say talent level, but the sort of talent that they have when they write and when they direct is befitting of the movies they were doing before they got, you know, a $200 million budget to make a space opera film. That's just, it's not really their playground. And Rian Johnson may be one of those writer directors, you know, Brick, Brothers Bloom, Looper, you know, action sci-fi, but somewhat modest nevertheless. And now two Knives Out films, it's, seems clear to me that, you know, you hit the tail on the donkey. It's like the guy does not need to answer yes if they ask him if he wants to direct a Batman movie or anything like that. It's like, no, nah, I'm good, man. I know what I'm doing. When I write my own scripts, it's fine.
Yeah, and then because, like, I, you know, I went kind of, you know, worried, because, like, I loved the first Ocean's 11 movie a lot, and I remember walking into Ocean's 12 at the time in 2004 with my friend and coming out pretty disappointed. I was like, oh, what if this ends up like that? But then, no, like, Knives Out, I was completely blown away. And granted, like, there were a lot of reaps of praise, like, before. Like, I know it premiered in London during the Global James, around the time of Global James Bond Week, and some of the Bond fans were there. And they told me it was spectacular, and how Rian Johnson hit it out of the park again. And then all the reviews kind of flowed in then. I did not attend TIFF this year, but I know received a lot of standing ovation at the TIFF, and then I did not I attended Montclair Film Festival, but I did not watch it at the Montclair Film Festival. And then what I liked about my evening with Josh Horowitz and Daniel Craig better than the one at Stephen Colbert was everyone had seen it versus the Montclair Film Festival. Only like 5 people saw it in the audience, so they couldn't really talk about the movie. So like this time we were able to just delve into the movie, both Glass Onion and, you know, Daniel Craig's career as a whole.
Yeah, I watched a little bit of the Josh Horowitz conversation. You know, the James Bond section obviously caught my eye. You know, did Daniel Craig say anything super revelatory that we hadn't heard before? Not really, but he seemed very relaxed. You know, I think he's quite happy that, he doesn't need to play James Bond anymore, so it's the rest of his career will be a little bit more relaxing, presumably. And secondly, he now has a new character that people cherish, and a character that he and Rian Johnson have created themselves. You know, it's originally from Rian Johnson's mind, but, you know, before 2019, no one knew what the hell a Benoit Blanc was, even Daniel Craig. So, you know, they had sort of created that character together. So I guess he's very happy of how these two films have turned out.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I know some people tend to like mistake Daniel Craig saying like he's relaxed, that he's not James Bond anymore. Like, that's not a sentiment that he alone shares. I remember when Timothy Dalton left James Bond in the early 90s and Pierce Brosnan took over, and someone asked Dalton like, oh, are you sad that you're not James Bond anymore? And Dalton replied, no, I feel free as a bird. I could drive down the Pacific Highway on, you know, along California, and then there's a billboard of Pierce Brosnan, not me, and I'm glad that I had my fun, but I'm glad that it's not me anymore. I'm happy for someone else take over. And I think that's the complete opposite of like sports, because Edgar, you and I are huge sports fans, and not so much these days anymore, but like back then a lot of athletes would get jealous if the next player or next franchise player would break so-and-so's record. And then I remember things like Jim Brown was really upset that the recently deceased Franco Harris of the Steelers could possibly break his rushing record, and he's like, oh, I'll come back, I'll sign with anybody so that record never gets broken. Right. But then in terms of the James Bond, the 6 actors, they never got jealous of each other. They're like, no, we just want this to carry on. And as Daniel Craig put it in one of the events I attended, he said, the best thing about Bond is it's not about me. It's, you know, it's about the franchise that just carries on. I'm just one piece of that story.
Yeah, no, he's absolutely right. So let's slowly but surely maybe get into Glass Onion. I like starting macro and then going micro. Yeah.
Spoiler warning. Spoiler warning. Spoiler.
So you've seen Glass Onion a few times. How many did you rewatch? Yes, you did. Of course you rewatched Knives Out. What's the matter? Only you did an episode with Emery. I also happened to rewatch Knives Out over the holiday weekend, the Christmas weekend. How different do you think the two films are? And maybe more specifically, how different do you think, if at all, Benoit Blanc is in these two films?
I think we see a lot more of Benoit Blanc's personal background in Glass Onion versus like, but I think in the way the two films differ is that in Knives, the first original one, we were revealed of the murder firsthand, and then we kind of like investigate the circumstances around it, versus like Glass Onion, we don't know what the case is, and we kind of see the movie from everyone's perspective, not mostly the perspective of Janelle Monáe's character, Benoit Blanc, and definitely Edward Norton's character, in that those three seem to like express their confusion and shock of how each other are interacting, and eventually we peel back the layers of the onion, and then we're like, oh, so this is what happened. And there was definitely, I think both cases, both movies were filled with treachery, but one was more, I'd say one was more open than the other.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because we sort of pre recording conversation, I was saying that when I rewatched Knives Out, one of the things that struck me was how the first third, let's say, of the picture adheres more or less to the traditional murder mystery template, where someone dies and the police show up and there's a detective, there's a private detective in the background, and they start asking questions. And Knives Out basically does that for a good 30, 40 minutes before revealing, spoilers if you haven't seen a three-year-old movie for which there's already a sequel, but before the film reveals that, oh no, like the poor little nurse did kill him, albeit by accident. Now we need to understand how it happened and how this is going to affect the will and this crazy family. Conversely, Glass Onion pulls the rug from under our feet in a completely different way. We're given the promise of a live-action game of Clue, so to speak, on Edward Norton's private island in Greece. And then, you know, the SHIT hits the fan when one of them actually dies, and the whole plot is sent into a tailspin to an extent even Edward Norton, who had invited his friends for a game of Clue, did not expect. And it just so happens Benoit Blanc is there. We'll get into the reasons why eventually. So, you know, structurally, there are similarities in the sense that the movie, each film does this one thing for about half an hour and then decides deliberately so, no, we're not doing this. This is what we're actually doing. The mysteries are different. The plots are very different. And the characters that evolve around these plots are different. But structurally, there are similarities between the two. In each case, the first third lures the viewer into a false sense of security, so to speak, and then the last two thirds is like, oh, this has nothing to do with the first third, you know.
Yep. And then I definitely love Benoit Blanc's delivery of the solution or the hypothesis presentation in both films, more so in this Glass Onion than I did Knives Out there.
Go ahead, Jason.
Because in the first one, he's like, Marta, you know, I spoke to the car, burned a donut hole in a donut hole inside another donut hole, but that donut hole is not a donut hole at all, but it's a hole in itself. And then this one, he's like, and the first one, the main question was Benoit Blanc asks, why was I hired in the first place? Because he himself didn't know. Versus in the second one, we see why he was hired, and then he asked the suspects who murdered Cassandra Brand, which is Janelle Monáe's character's twin sister that she plays both characters of, and then we kind of come to reveal the layers of the story behind it.
Of course, well, this being a private detective story, there needs to be a sequence with I won't call him a protagonist, because I do think Ana de Armas and Janelle Monáe are the true protagonists of their stories, but this very important supporting character who is a private detective, you know, we need a scene where they regale not just the characters present, but us, the viewers. They need to regale us in the juicy details of how it all went down. I don't know which one I like more. I'm speaking to the sequences where Benoit Blanc shares all. I think they're both pretty good. But I guess that maybe bleeds into my next question. How good do you think the mystery is in Glass Onion?
I'd say the mystery was less of a mystery in the Glass Onion, because like it was always hiding in plain sight. And as I rewatched it two more times since the original, like everything, like for instance, I mean, like I said, this is a spoiler episode. Like when the first time we see Janelle Monáe's character run to Benoit Blanc, like when the lights turn off on the island, Benoit was like, "Helen, did you find it?" He says, "Helen, did you find it?" And then I didn't. When you first watch the movie, you don't really think about it. But then second or third time, I'm like, oh, he actually called her Helen instead of Andy, you know, because, you know, they were behind this entire thing.
Interesting. I've seen it twice, and I don't know. Is it because the music? I don't know. I did not hear that. And of course, the first time I wouldn't have picked up on it. I wouldn't have picked up on it at all. It's the mystery is interesting. Here's where I actually start to think that both Knives Out and Glass Onion stray different paths. I think the mystery, what happened, who did it, why, and what are all the little puzzle pieces that need to be put together, I think it's a bit stronger in Knives Out. I think what Glass Onion is doing and what Rian Johnson as the writer and the director of the movie is doing, I think he's given himself a more difficult task of surprising the audience. I think he enjoyed, and he's very good at it, by the way. This is not a criticism, but I think he enjoys this game of one-upmanship. Not just one-upping Knives Out, but one-upping information, previous information that we thought was true in Glass Onion. And I think he likes doing that, and he seems to enjoy giving himself the challenge, challenging himself to constantly one-up it. I think in that respect, Glass Onion is probably the more entertaining of the two movies.
I would agree with that.
It's uproariously funny. Not to say Knives Out isn't funny. Actually, I chuckled quite a bit whenever you watched Knives Out the other day. But I was laughing out loud a lot more with Glass Onion. So I think the one-upmanship is superior in Glass Onion. I think if you're... Again, these are sort of like dramedies, if you will. But if you're a little bit more attached to your, well, what's the mystery? You know, how intelligent is the mystery? I think maybe Knives Out is the better movie. It's tighter, possibly.
I think that's a fair assessment. And that was kind of like what I felt the very first time I watched it. But then the second or third times I watched it, like, I was just more entertained by the entire story. And I remember at the Montclair Film Festival, Daniel Craig complained that my only complaint about Glass Onion is that when people are laughing, watching it together, they laugh so hard that they miss the next joke. The first time I watched it with my friend in a half-empty theater, because it was Thanksgiving, we didn't have that problem. But then when I watched it with the Bond community and my friends at the 92nd Street Y, like, everyone was just laughing at all the jokes or the sequences, like, you know, like, especially anything that Kate Hudson said, because, like, her character was a complete dipshit. It was like, I guess she was supposed to be like a Kim Kardashian type of person, or what, I don't know who she was modeled after, but, you know, along those lines. And then and when you're laughing at her jokes, you laugh so hard through the next joke. And so that's why I was so happy when I watched it last night at home. I watched it with subtitles, so, you know, in case I laughed hard, I could read the next joke.
Right. You were saying when you saw it in theaters, not film festival, we're talking theatrical experience, it wasn't an empty, or it wasn't a full room?
I mean, granted, the theater is a pretty big theater, so, and I saw, like, Wednesday afternoon, like, while people were still at work, Wednesday matinee, so it was still, I mean, it was a respectable size, but not like the 92nd Street Y, where it was just a 900 people packed theater. Stage.
Right. No, I think I saw it in the evening with a local friend, and it was pretty packed, and the crowd, they ate it up. It was an enjoyable and respectful crowd that night. I had a pleasant time. You laughed quite a bit, and the crowd laughed quite a bit when you saw it in New York. What are some of your favorite? Do you have a favorite moment? Do you have a favorite joke in the film? Is there something that gets you every time?
I guess, like, Dave Bautista's interactions with his mom, that was definitely one. when Kate Hudson and was it Jessica Henwick? It's Jessica Henwick, right?
Kate Hudson's assistant is Jessica Henwick. Yeah, I think she says it. Hanick. I think she says, yeah. Hanick.
When they say, he's like, what's this for, my second cell phone? And then her character's name is Peggy. He was like, hey, Birdie, you did not think sweatshops are where sweatpants are made from. And then, or he was like, I'm spiritually like Harriet Tubman and Beyonce. And, you know, like, all these like very tone-deaf political incorrect statements. And
it's funny, Peggy's is by far the least important character on that island, but she is given a few scenes. And it's funny, I remember watching the film the first time, going back a bit, a month and change, and I felt a little bit sorry for that character. Oh my goodness, she has to do PR. Yeah, loopholes. She has to jump PR loopholes for the Kate Hudson's character's idiocy. I didn't feel that anymore the second time. And the clincher for me was the sweatshop email discussion they have, because the Jessica Hannett character is justifiably shocked and appalled, and I'm like, you're an idiot. Why are you still with Kate Hudson? Like, this is you're digging your own grave here, girl. I'm sorry, but you're in this with her. Too bad. I suddenly felt a little bit less forgiving towards the Jessica Hannett character this time, because I'm like, what? Just find another job, damn it.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I thought all the characters were very well developed. Like, Catherine Hahn as the Connecticut governor running for Senate, and then second time rewatching, I was like, wait a sec, this is a How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days reunion, because like she and Kate Hudson were in that movie together in the early 2000s, and watching this movie again, I was like, I totally forgot how much I had a crush on Kate Hudson back in middle school and high school. I mean, she's still gorgeous, and my friends who I watch, female friends who I watch with, they're like, oh yeah, Kate Hudson's still so hot, and Leslie Odom's a Lionel's a very brilliant scientist, and obviously, I mean, watching this, like I said, watching this again, like, and many other films, like, it just shows like how extremely talented Edward Norton is as an actor. Like, he never like chews up the scenery, but like he makes you like really like feel like an antagonized or like carries the weight of the scene with him. And I thought he was a very brilliant portrayal of like both a mixture of like Elon Musk and Steve Jobs, and that both those tech giants were known for like pushing their employees to the limit. Like Lionel says, he faxed me his ideas at middle of the night, and that's what Elon Musk is kind of notorious for. Like, he tells people to get in a teleconference at 3 a.m. in the morning. I was like, oh, hell that. I was like, that's why when I got rejected from SpaceX and Tesla, I was like, I didn't even feel bad, because like, I was like, I don't want to do that.
Right. These brilliant messages that come on fax through fax machines in the middle of the night, and a child equals NFT, and just the bizarre thing. Like, what is this guy a genius or is he an idiot? Stay tuned. Do you have a favorite cast member or characters? Is there some? Because there certainly is one for me, and it's. But I'm curious to know about. Is there someone that stood out? And you're not allowed to say Daniel Craig as Benoit Blanc.
I would say either between Edward Norton's Braun and Miles Braun, and obviously Janelle Monáe's character. Because the only thing I've ever seen Janelle Monáe is in Hidden Figures as one of the scientists, but I've never seen her in much anything else. And definitely, I think Edward Norton's character was really well done. I mean, he was much more different antagonist than Chris Evans' character in the first one. Because like Chris Evans' character, you actually felt for him until the very end when the treachery was revealed. Whereas like, I thought Edward Norton just really commanded great presence in every single scene that he was in.
Yeah, it was a bit of an interesting reminder about how good of an actor he really is, or the range, I should say. He really can play pretty much anything, Edward Norton, that is. I mean, for me, the standout for me is the other person you mentioned, Janelle Monáe. I'm not going to claim that I'm particularly familiar with her as a musical artist, nor have I seen her. But to the best of my knowledge, I haven't seen her in anything else. But I'm aware that she has played in a few things, and I'm aware that she's a very popular singer. To me, and I think I had this conversation walking out of the theater with my my friend when I saw it in theaters, was this could be, time will tell, but this could be, our new Ana de Armas, where you've heard the name, you sort of vaguely know who that is, but then everybody goes to see Knives Out, and it's like, who the hell is this actress? And I wonder if this could be the same thing. We're like, oh, we've all heard the name Janelle Monáe. I mean, I knew the name heading into Glass Onion, but I walked out going, no, she's an actor. Like, she can act. Dual role, completely different roles, and there's some scenes where she's kind of triple acting. She plays Helen, she plays Andy, and she plays Helen pretending to be Andy. She's kind of playing three things. She's kind of doing three things in this movie.
I love the way she calls them the shitheads.
The shitheads.
Yeah.
Or when they were kids, my sister Andy, you know, she used to call them rich bitch, you know. Oh, the dog ate the caviar. You know, like a rich bitch. Yeah, so Janelle Monáe would be my personal standout. You know, but I think she's already successful, even if she chooses to never act in another movie again. But she has her other career. But if she wants to pursue acting some more, this is a hell of a breakout role for her. Hell of a breakout role.
Oh, yeah. And then I also want to continue talking about, or continue segue into Miles Braun, because me being me, the location scouter that I am, I found that the island where they filmed the movie is an actual resort. It's called the Amen Resorts. It's like a franchise, I think. And it's the Amen Resort Villa 20 on Porto Helion, Greece. And so the glass onion where Edward Norton's office, that's CGI. But then everything else around, everything else, the pool, the rooms look exactly the same. Mm-hmm. On the website as it did in the film. And I believe, because mind you, this was filmed during like summer 2021 while the COVID was still going. And that's what I wanted to bring, is like, I'm glad that this movie like took into factor the COVID situation, because like it was able to relate to the audience with immediate effect, because you know, we all went through the 2-3 years of, you know, lockdowns.
Yeah. And I was meaning to add, that was actually one of my discussion points. I'll let you elaborate first, though. Did you have anything else to add about the pandemic point? Or?
Oh, no, I was just going to say the resort is $1,000, $1,800 a night. And if anyone wants to split the cost with me, because you get a big ass room with the pool that Dave Bautista and Kate Hutt and Madeline Klein, you know, comes out of.
Whiskey, character's name. Yeah. Weird name.
So if you guys ever want to split a room with me, just hit me. You guys know where to find me.
DM the James Bond Complex Instagram account.
And then Matt Spazer told me that Benoit Blanc's residence, he actually knew where it was. It's like Lenox Hill in New York City, and he used to live several blocks from it. So he recognized it when we watched the movie together.
You know, that little moment struck me when we go back in time again to the sort of, I guess, the true start of the plot, and we see Benoit Blanc. You know, I you could have quizzed me all you wanted and had me guess 1,000 times where he lived. I didn't know. Man, he must get paid very, very well to solve these crimes if he has a high-rise Manhattan condo. Like, what is he charging to solve these crimes? Good gracious.
And then he gets, and his partner slash roommate is none other than Hugh Grant, one of the many cameos. And then he was playing that, I'm not a huge gamer, but like I remember when I was watching the movie, like he was playing that video game on his laptop, like everyone was during quarantine. Like my friend's like, oh, my nephew actually plays that game, and I forget what it's like, this R's game, something like that. And he was playing it with like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and I was just laughing.
Weird. Yeah, there were a couple faces I didn't recognize. One of them is a rest in peace, Angela Lansbury. She's on that Zoom call, and the other gentleman, the name escapes me.
Steven Sondheim.
Yeah, musical theater.
He was the composer of West Side Story, both the old 1961 and the new one. And then he was the cameo at Kate Hudson's party. Is like, oh, everything's going woke, and then we see Yo-Yo.
Yo-Yo much. I was like, what the hell is going on? And we have another cameo, a very, very big name suddenly shows up as Miles's like a driver or whatever. Ethan Hawke shows up to give he never says what it is. He just says, you know, open your mouth, stick out your tongue, this hurt a little bit. And then he just insists that you're good. What is that exactly? You're good.
It's like the Men in Black neuralizers, what they said.
Right. So that was Serena Williams shows up for a scene. Well, shows up virtually. She shows up for a scene. Is there anybody? Jeremy Renner's face shows up for a quick moment as the logo of the hot sauce on the bottle.
I couldn't recognize this, but because Rian Johnson has worked with Joseph Gordon-Levitt quite a bit, but I heard the gong voice was Joseph Gordon-Levitt saying gong.
I heard that too. I think, you know, sometimes you just give work to a friend because they like working together, even if the cameo doesn't really mean anything. I never in a million years would I have guessed Joseph Gordon-Levitt is saying gong. But apparently it's him. It was nice to see, not that I recognized him at the time. I had to figure out that in the credits, but the hippie bum who's sort of just relaxing while all this is going down is actually Noah Segan, who's a frequent, Rian Johnson. Yep.
I would not have guessed that.
If you don't remember who Noah Segan is, it's the other detective in Knives Out. So not the Keith Stanfield, but the other detective who's like a real fan of murder mysteries. And he keeps saying, this is like in that book. It's the same actor. He plays the hippie bum who's sort of just smoking joints all the time. I'm not here.
And you wanted to go into the pandemic factor of this?
Well, not too much. I mean, I think, you know, at the time of this recording, we sort of lived our first year where we didn't have to talk about the pandemic too much, which maybe made it slightly annoying that was included in this movie. It's funny, we don't need to get into the topic, but just the other day in our messenger board, we sort of briefly touched upon another movie franchise that needed to get or chose to get in the moment to deal with something. This is not the time or place to get into that one. And Glass Onion does the same. And I've always sort of, in 20 years from now, is anybody going to give a shit about the fact that, all right, in 2020, there was a global pandemic. That's why they're wearing masks for the first 5 minutes of this movie. I'm always like one of those things where it's like, well, yeah, it's cute for us. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be cute for the people who watch this in 20 years? I'm sorry for being so secretive. I just don't think it's the time for it. But I sort of said the same thing when we broached the other topic in our messenger discussion. I'm like, I get why they did it, but is the very next generation going to give a shit? Like, are we not a little bit too much in the moment sometimes with these things? But whatever.
And I heard that's why Serena Williams filmed her scene virtually, because, you know, it's during the pandemic. And Daniel Craig was really Rian Johnson suggested casting Cute Grant as his partner, and Daniel's like, oh yeah, go for him, because I'm a huge fan of Cute Grant. But because of the pandemic, and, you know, like, they're filming like all around the world, not all mm-hmm. around the world, but they had to film like in certain countries with, you know, certain specific protocols. So that's why you mm-hmm. never see Cute Grant share scene mm-hmm. screen time with any other person except for Janelle Monáe, because, like, I don't even think they were in the same studio at the time, because, like, it was just what Rian Johnson and Daniel Craig said in an interview was like, Hugh Grant filmed his scene virtually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's true. What is he's messy because it's paint, right? He's a painter?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or is he a cook?
He's a painter.
So strange. But it's funny. It's funny. Everybody loves Hugh Grant. Why not put him in the movie for 20 seconds? How important is it, and I'm not insinuating that it is or that it isn't, I'm genuinely curious, for you, Jason Kim, for instance, how important is it that so far, two films into this eventual trilogy and maybe beyond, how important is it that so far Benoit Blanc has ostensibly come to the aid of people who, quote, deserved it, end quote, because Ana de Armas deserves it for a bunch of reasons that you and Emery got into in the other episode, and the Janelle Monáe characters sort of deserve to be helped in Glass Onion. Is that particularly important to these films' success? What do you make of that? Do you like it? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Share your thoughts down below.
I like the way the characters are really well characterized in that, because I don't think, like, the movies were going too political by any means. Like, I know, like, everyone has their own political senses, but I thought in both cases justice was served, and it just shows that we as audiences don't always know what's going on behind the scenes of each individual character until someone like Benoit mm-hmm. Blanc really delves into it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly makes the films a lot more palatable because we've had two. Again, if we sort of, for argument's sake, Benoit Blanc is not the protagonist. You know, the protagonists have been Ana de Armas and Janelle Monáe, which they are for several mm-hmm. reasons. You know, it certainly makes them a lot more palatable, where we sort of feel for Ana de Armas because of her circumstances. And I think those scenes between her and Christopher Plummer just before he passes away, so to speak, guy slits his own throat. But those scenes between her and Christopher Plummer are quite critical because we can tell there's a genuine friendship there, and we can tell that an honest mistake was done. Mm-hmm. And conversely, with the flashbacks, when not Andy, Helen knocks on Benoit Blanc's door, we can tell that you know, she's a pretty good person too, and Benoit Blanc is keen to help her. There is a part of me that, I'm not making a suggestion for Rian Johnson, he can do, you know, whatever the heck he wants, but there is a part of me that wonders, what if he capped off this trilogy in slightly, I say slightly more cynical fashion, with a third Knives Out movie where Benoit Blanc is like, look, you hired me, you paid me, so I'm gonna help you, but you're like a fecushing douchebag. Why am I helping this person? But he's just so good at what he does that he's going to help them anyways. Because so far he's come to the aid of people where it's like, oh, well, you know, we want Janelle Monáe to win and we want Ana de Armas to win. They're fun characters. They're nice people. You know, I wonder what's it like when Benoit Blanc gets really, really well paid and does the job, but for a freaking asshole.
For like, we get that moment in the movie where Edward Miles Braun hides behind Benoit Blanc and says, I'll pay you right. $1 billion if you can figure out which one's that's trying to kill me. And then because like the whole time, like Benoit Blanc explains the mystery to Miles Braun, and he's like, he said you pretty much created a powder keg situation when you invited five people who have a motivation against you, and then it's like turning off the lights and with the gun in the room, and then later on, Benoit Blanc eventually, like, you know, responds in anger. It was stupider than that. It's just plain stupid. It's dumb. It's dumb. And he's like, what makes it dumb is he stole my own idea.
Yeah. I like the part where, I remember sitting in the theater and I could not stop laughing, you know, before anybody's died. And they're at the dinner, you know, they're having dinner, and, you know, Edward Norton's like, well, the Murder Mercy's about to start. Benoit Blanc just solves everything.
Yeah.
And they go up to his office, and as Edward Norton says, you know, I got, what's her name?
Jillian Flynn.
I need Jillian Flynn to write that. Oh, she's pretty good. She's goddamn expensive. there's some great lines in very character driven lines in this movie. Oh, did you catch the I couldn't believe they put this in the movie. Did you catch the 2000, not the 2001 Space Odyssey joke, the 2010, the year we made contact joke? It's full of stars. It's like 2010. It's like, what is that in the movie?
And that do I get to win an iPad? No, you get to win an iPad Pro, and he throws the iPad at him.
Well, even before that, I just like the part where he says, oh, dude, what do we win? You know, no. I was just wondering, you know, if we won, you know, do we win something? Sure, you get an iPad.
I thought that, like many interviews have said, like, it looked like Daniel Craig was really relishing this movie, pun intended, actually.
Yes, he does. We sort of started this review with that talking point, you know, how different is this version of Benoit Blanc? If we go by the two films we've had so far, I wonder, and this makes me even more curious about the third in this trilogy, this eventual trilogy, is it feels as though Benoit Blanc sort of bleeds into the setting of where he is, because he's funny in Knives Out, but not always uproariously so. And it's sort of in the northeastern United States. You can tell it's in the fall. There's a chill in the air. The palette is a little gray and brown. Whereas here, we're in the summer. I think the movie starts in May. We go to Greece. It's always sunny. People are dressed, you know, very sexifully. He, you know, dresses to his own style, I suppose. So, yeah, it's a bit more of a colorful Benoit Blanc. Again, I don't mean to insinuate that I didn't think he was colorful in the first one. He is. But yeah, everything is sort of kicked up a notch. The whole movie, the whole setting is more colorful.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Because of that, it's almost like Benoit Blanc is more colorful suddenly as well, to an extent anyways.
Now I think about it, both the first one and the second were made as a result of No Time That being delayed.
The first one, certainly. I don't remember the second one. But
So what happened was the first one was made because, like, you know, after the Danny Boyle fiasco happened, they're like, oh, we're going to push the production date. We don't know when. And then Daniel Craig signed on to the first one. And the first one took like 5-6 weeks in Boston. And by the time he was done, or close to when he was done, they said Cary Fukunaga's going to direct it. And then obviously during COVID, No Time That got delayed 4 more times. And at the time, the eventual September 2021 date didn't get delayed. But, you know, everyone was still like, you know, on the fence, like, is going to get delayed or not. And then before the premiere happened, Daniel Craig flew out to Greece and filmed the entire movie in like 7 weeks, 7-8 weeks, or like 2 months. And I think, like, you could see it within the cast, like, everyone was colorful because, like, you know, because everyone was locked down or quarantined for a year and a half, they just were happy to be together. Like the movie says, oh, can we hug now? Can we, like, you know, shake hands? And you could see it in every actor's portrayal. And so that's what I'm saying. Is like, and then as a result, and then eventually once once Glass Onion finished filming, Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson set the green light. No, we're having the No Time That premiere at the end of September. No questions asked.
I think delays surrounding No Time to Die had a much greater influence on Knives Out than maybe Glass Onion. I think they were going to make Glass Onion regardless. Knives Out was too much of a success. Whether they made Glass Onion while we were questioning if there would be a No Time to Die premiere or not, I think they were going to make it anyways. I would say No Time to Die's colorful history had a significant impact on the very existence of Knives Out. I mean, we're probably not talking about Glass Onion today. Who knows? You know, alternate timelines and parallel universes, but there is a chance we're not even having this conversation, you and I, today. And you didn't have your conversation with Emery if, you know, Danny Boyle doesn't decide to shoot James Bond into space or whatever the hell it was he wanted to do there.
And then because, like, I remember, like, at all the interviews, and even in some of the interviews that I've attended at the Montclair or the No Time That premiere, he said, like, I really didn't think the premiere was going to happen. So I was so happy I got to shoot the Knives Glass Onion, like, in that interim period. And I wanted to go a little more into not our protagonist, but our reprising character, Benoit Blanc, just like Daniel's Bond. I'm not a fashion guru like Spacer or Simon Roscoe or Peter Booker by any means, but I really appreciate the fashion or the costume work in both films. I remember after the first film, I bought the gray car coat that he wears in the first or throughout the entire movie. And after this movie, I still can't find the shirts, the pink shirt and then the sky blue shirt that he wears with the cocktail cussling. And then Simon, Peter, Kyle Barbeau, you know, the fashion gurus of the Bond community, told me that it's made by Anto Shirts, who makes custom-made shirts for a lot of movie characters for Hollywood, and then they sometimes do mass releases, but they do provide the same shirts if you order it. And though this outfit doesn't make the most prominent appearance, but I really like the sweater that he wears. the light sweater that he wears when he talks with Helen before on the night before they go on the island. He's like, this is your last chance to back out. And I thought this when I first saw it, I was like, it really reminded me of Cary Grant's character in To Catch a Thief when he's like,
I'd have to rewatch it. I don't remember Cary Grant's costumes very well, but I'll take your word for it.
So like when Cary Grant's like kind of like acting as a cat burglar at the end of the movie, I was like, oh wow, that's actually, it kind of reminds me of that. And, you know, both movies are set in very like sun, you know, like warm climates, and I thought it was very, and then that's what the costume designer said, it was like Cary Grant's inspiration. Cary Grant's look was an inspiration for the movie. And then another actor that I'm not too familiar with was Jacques Tati. The actor Jacques Tati, a French actor.
I think he's mostly known for being a director. He may have acted. I know he's made a lot of movies. He's sort of a comedic director.
So like the hat that Benoit Blanc wears at the end of the movie, at the final shot of the movie, that does, I Googled Google image just who Jacques Tati was, because I'm not very familiar with his work, and then I was like, oh, that is a Jacques Tati hat.
Interesting. I'm not familiar enough with my Jacques Tati to grasp maybe why they would make that reference. Although from what I understand, Jacques Tati made comedic movies that maybe were constructed a little bit like puzzles, if you will,
That's what Benoit Blanc's Knives Out trilogy is becoming.
Possibly. Maybe Benoit Blanc would have fit right into a Jacques. I'd have to watch a Jacques Tati film to know for sure. The costumes are quite good. Everybody is dressed. I like what Leslie Odom Jr. is wearing. He's that nice
green,
dark green. Yeah, no, that's a very, very nice outfit. Probably the quietest character in the movie. Maybe he gets a little bit lost in the shuffle just because he's more the scientific mind. He doesn't have sort of bold statements to make a whole lot. He's a little bit more quiet.
And he's not really, he never really caught me as nefarious or had like ulterior motives. And speaking of ulterior motives, like what I really like in this movie that they showed is when Benoit Blanc and Helen creates that chart of all the characters, and it was like motivation and opportunities. I was like, that's what, and then eventually she ruled everybody out because like they didn't have any motive to kill Cassandra. And then I took that same exact chart and used it to watch the first Knives Out, and then and I still came up with the first conclusion where what's that Miami Vice
Collins.
I still came up with the same conclusion that it was either Toni Collette or Jamie Lee Curtis's husband were the suspects.
Don Johnson.
Yeah. Because like they were the only ones who, in my mind, who had the opportunity and the motivation behind Harlan's murder in the first. I mean, eventually that's not what happened, but that's who I would have narrowed it down to.
Right. Yeah. No, they had pretty good motivations. It's funny. That was one of my talking points. I'm sort of happy you the conversation has bled into that. I was going to ask you if you thought all the people present on the island had a good enough reason to be considered possible murderers. Because my second viewing, sort of enlightened me a little bit on who these characters are, and a little bit like you, you know, again, going back to my earlier point, why I think maybe Knives Out has the slightly better mystery plot, especially if we're talking about murder mysteries. I think Knives Out is a little bit superior because there are more enlivening candidates, good fits for being murderers, you know, in addition to everybody in that family being just the most despicable people. Whereas the people who show up to the Greek island, there aren't a whole lot of them that, like, oh, yeah, that person definitely would have killed Edward Norton if they had the chance. I two viewings, and I'm not under the impression that half the people that show up would hurt a fly. They might kill a fly accidentally because a couple of them are like freaking idiots. They're morons. They'd sit on a fly and not know they did it. But they wouldn't have enough, there's not enough malice in their bodies to want to kill Edward Norton, which is why I think it's very important for Glass Onion's success that it plays this game of very, oh, really? Oh, really? This game of one-upmanship that's very funny and the twists are very colorful because, again, I'm not sure the mystery is great in Glass Onion.
I didn't think that... I'll agree. I mean, I think that was my initial complaint when I first saw the movie, that I didn't think the mystery was as great as the first one, but I think that also was the point of the movie, and that's what Edward Norton's character says about the Mona Lisa, who he quote-unquote loaned from the Louvre in the movie. He says, the thing about the Mona Lisa is this, this simple thing that you're looking at suddenly takes layers and depth so complex it gives you vertigo, and and that's kind of like an analogy to the movie. And or as Daniel Craig's character says, is that the object that seems densely layered, but in reality, the center is hiding, is in plain sight. It's not even hiding at all. And I think I do agree that the mystery wasn't really. I'm not sure if it's not underdeveloped or it was just never there, but the mystery was definitely better in Knives Out, the first one, versus like in this one. It does keep purporting to that claim that, you know, there is no mystery, everything's open in the plain sight, and it was always there,
which is a way of making an entertaining movie. Like none of what I said a few moments ago is an argument why it's an unentertaining film. On the contrary, I think it's wildly uproariously entertaining movie. You know, it's a damn good time. You know, 2 hours watching Netflix, believe me, I would encourage anyone to check this out at least once. You know, whether you want to see it a second time to fit the pieces of the puzzle, but itself.
But yeah, it's not like the true murder mystery, like you said. Because like we both said, the characters in this movie, I didn't really feel the motive, the malice, or the opportunistic opportunities out of all of them. The only character I saw who was being opportunistic were Catherine Hahn's senator character and Dave Bautista's right-wing YouTuber, but then those two didn't have the malice, but they had the, you know, the greed of wanting, versus like in the first Knives Out, every character in that movie just clearly looked like they had both the greed, malice, and
I agree. Because it's you know, the Dave Bautista character is an interesting one, where, you know, he's an easy character to make fun of because of, you know, what he does online. He's like a streamer of some sort, you know, with whiskey. Oops, I love my tips. My tits. And it's like, who are these people? So it's not because they're easy to mock and they stand for what they stand for that they're necessarily evil people. Like, neither of them are particularly evil people. But those are two more people on this, characters on this island, where I'm like, well, neither Whiskey or Duke are going to kill Edward Norton. Like, I don't think they have it in them to do that. It doesn't matter what they stand for. Speaking of Edward Norton, if I may, And if you don't understand the question, I'll elaborate a little bit more. But do you think the writing that went into Miles Braun is consistent enough? After all, he's proven to be rather stupid by Benoit Blanc. You know, he's saying words that don't exist, and he stole from Benoit Blanc's own idea to sort of kill Dave Bautista. But he still sort of made a name for himself. Like, two viewings of this film, I have a bit of a difficult handle on Miles Braun. Like, is he as stupid as Benoit Blanc claims he is? Should I be giving his character more credit? Because he does make Kate Hudson's character big. He does help Catherine Hahn's character. So he can't be that moronic.
But he also
the punchline is he's an idiot. So I don't really understand that part.
I mean, and then Benoit Blanc also says to Cassandra or Helen that Miles Braun definitely didn't kill Cassandra because he's not stupid. He would have hired someone to do it. And then, but so I think he kind of played with his own words. And I definitely agree with you. And I don't disagree with what you're saying, but this is the way, me having gone to technical university, you know, like having idolized, not just me, but having idolized the people like the Steve Jobs, Elon Musk. I definitely idolized Elon Musk for a very long time until like more recent news. I mean, not the, or even Jeff Bezos for that matters. And I always saw them as geniuses because, you know, they were like, you know, being the frontier of people, you know, they're being like the frontier visionaries, which they still are. I'm definitely not doubting that. But then the more you got to know them, you're like, at least, I mean, I won't go into the Elon Musk because that's another different topic. But like, at least Steve Jobs, like, I remember after his passing, like, you know, everyone's like, oh, like, this was, we lost a great man. And then when you look more into Steve Jobs, you're like, he never really created anything. Like, I mean, this is not a knock on Steve Jobs. Like, he didn't create the circuitry of, like, he didn't create the iPhone. I mean, he knew how to push people to the limits, like, or as Michael Fassbender says, like, Michael Fassbender's character and Jobs is like, heaven and earth were created in 7 days. You had 2 weeks to create the iPhone and you failed. Like, right. And so, like, so I think Miles Brown is kind of is like that. Like, he knows how to push people and, like, you know, like, he's very
he can surround, he knows who to surround himself with.
Yes, he knows how, and but he doesn't have the technical knowledge to, like, drive a company. Like, it was a lot of it was like the Steve Wozniackis and, you know, the other technical experts. But, like, whereas, like, Jobs or Elon Musk, they never created anything that they particularly started. They, like you said, they're good at surrounding themselves with the people who are the experts. In this case, in the movie's case, it's Lionel. And then even when Lionel says, like, you know, hydrogen fuel is gonna be is a little too volatile to be released to the public, and he still doesn't listen. And that's, and I think that really does a good job characterizing Miles Brown and the way I viewed, you know, idolized all these tech entrepreneurs from an early age and then to the revelations later on.
Right. So basically, people with visions, and you need a particular brain to envision something like that, but they need help. They can't do it on their own. But if they didn't exist, no one would have the vision. So they are still important in that respect. And maybe Miles Brown is that type of a character. Like, no one else would have thought of the things he did, but he wouldn't have been able to started up on his own. He needed a Leslie Odom Jr. He needed a Catherine Hahn to promote it. He needed a, I don't know why. I still don't know why he needs Dave Bautista. But why is Dave Bautista in this movie? But, you know, he needed a few people, a few key people, be it a scientist or a politician, to vouch for his stuff, to make it happen. But he did maybe come up with, well, what if we came up with this new energy source, or not new energy source, but what if we recycled a very old idea, despite how dangerous it is?
I mean, it's like, that's kind of like a Steve Jobs was like, I mean, I don't want to go too down the rabbit hole, because I remember when the iPad was first released in 2010, like, the social media and just media as a whole were just like destroying Steve Jobs, like, oh, that's such a stupid idea, and people are calling it the maxi pad, the tampon pads, you know, like, making fun of the iPads. And 10, 12 years later, everyone has a tablet PC, like, whether it be an iPad or whatever other brand. And that's kind of like what Steve Jobs and Miles Brown are. Like, they're visionaries. They're very eccentric, but they're not the most technically astute people.
No, I guess so. I guess so.
And I want to read this one review of Knives Out that I read from The Empire. It's a review summary. It says, Knives Out, Glass Onion Mystery is a bigger, bolder, funnier, and angrier sequel that improves on almost every aspect of its predecessor. Rian Johnson plays with an airtight script that targets the absurdity and the stupidity of the 1% while delivering a hilarious murder mystery on the most luxurious private island not owned by a Bond villain.
Yeah, I guess interesting commentary. I'm not going to get into social commentary or anything. I think maybe the review sort of assuming that anybody in the 1% is automatically an idiot. I think you need some intelligence to get to be in the 1%. So I'm not going to go that far. But it's certainly a fun example of how an individual who you know, does have some smarts, but he's clearly not as smart as he thinks he is. And he sort of fumbles it. I don't want to say fumble, but because he surrounds himself with the right people, and because he pushes people in the right direction until he pushes Janelle Monáe too far, he makes it into that 1%. And as Benoit Blanc points out, you know, when it comes to maybe some simpler things in life, he's not that intelligent. I think it's interesting to see how someone who might be in the 1% and they got there for reasons X, Y, Z, and I'm sure part of it has to do with cunning and part of it has to do with savvy business sense and savvy entrepreneurship. But sometimes people, I say sometimes, I'm trying to be careful with my words as possible here, but sometimes people who are so good at those things, entrepreneurship and surrounding themselves with talent, which are important things for financial and sometimes political success, but when it comes to other things like just, you know, one-on-one relations, they're goofballs, you know, they're clowns. And I think maybe Glass Onion is a very entertaining interpretation of what someone like that might be like. And when they hit a roadblock, such as when Duke's phone goes off and it turns out, oh, the person in this room apparently is dead. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a person like Miles Braun gets the brilliant idea of, I need to kill my friend right now, which is the worst thing to do, you know. Yeah. So it's an entertaining depiction of what someone like that would be. I don't know if I'm going to agree with the idiocy of the 1%. I think you have to be a little smart to be in the 1%.
Oh, no, I think I agree with that too. But I don't think the entire review was targeting towards Miles Braun's character, but that entire collective group, because like sometimes people say the 1% can be very out of touch, and that's, and we see that a lot in Kate Hudson's character for sure.
Yeah, well, the Kate Hudson character is, I mean, that's certainly an exaggeration of Birdie J is an exaggeration of, or maybe not, she's not such an exaggeration of people who are, you know, rich and famous and they made it. They got there for reasons X, Y, Z, and go make your money. No problem there. But they don't have much else. And what's between the ears is maybe not as developed as your ordinary human being. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sweatshop email conversation is, you know, that's sort of the clincher. Although I do like the exchange between Birdie J and Benoit Blanc when they're sort of having the little
champagne. Like,
and he, I actually think it's one of the funniest lines in the movie where Benoit turns to her and says, you know, it's a dangerous thing to confuse
speaking without thought and speaking the truth.
And then to which she replies, oh, so you're saying I'm dangerous. That's probably one of the best lines in the movie. Like, this bird, huh? It's Birdie J. This bird does, no, she doesn't get it. Yeah. It's not getting it. It's not getting into their head there. Which is why I am not on board with the Jessica Hannig character anymore. I'm like, you should have left this woman so long ago. You are digging your own grave, girl.
And then I only found out at the end, at the credits of the movie, that because I love the credits at the end of the movie where there's a very good colorful illustration of each individual mm-hmm. character of the cast. And only then did I learn that Glass Onion is a Beatles song on the White Album. I never knew that.
Well, I guess we can all be Beatles fans.
I mean, I did like a lot of the music choices, like the Starman and Star by David Bowie was used, and there are mm-hmm. plenty of other musical choices, obviously Yo-Yo Ma and his cameo, but and then mm-hmm. and then Glass Onion to end the movie.
Yes, it's only one of the most popular songs, but whatever. Mm-hmm. Are there any, we've been going on for a decent little bit, we don't want to tire the listeners out. Are there any, I'm going to stop my discussion points. I have a few more, but they're not life or death questions. Is there anything else about Glass Onion that you want to bring up?
No, I think I covered everything I did.
Interesting. Let me just, oh, hold on a second. The damn phone is, who's DMing me on Instagram?
Is it Monsieur Blanc himself?
Oh my God, is it Benoit? It's the wrong Monsieur Blanc. It's Monsieur White. He's asking, in fact, he's not asking me, he is asking me a question. He's asking me to ask you if we have people everywhere.
We do have people everywhere. We got people in Aman resorts in Greece, New York City, Toronto, Montreal, Michigan.
That's right. We got people everywhere, including online. Some would claim those are not real places, but there's a Facebook page, search for the James Bond Complex. There's Instagram, which is at the James Bond Complex. We're on YouTube, search for the James Bond Complex. Subscribe and tickle us with the thumbs up button. What else now? There's Anchor.fm, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and the best in the business, Apple Podcasts. Search for the James Bond Complex. Write a review. Leave us a 5-star glowing golden gun review and tell us what you thought of Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery. Jason, if I'm not mistaken, you are also an independent. You also have an independent account online.
You guys can find me on Instagram at JASXON88, where you will continue to see posts related to Glass Onion, or you may have seen posts related to Knives Out, a Glass Onion. And you will continue to see posts that are related to Glass Onion and From Fleming to Film and everything in between for the rest of 2023.
Well, that sounds very titillating, Jason. Thank you for that. Thank you for your services. So I guess on that note, just as James Bond always returns, well, we know James Bond is going to return at some point.
So too will Benoit Blanc.
He has to. I mean, they Netflix spent more than enough money for two movies, and they got one. So we know Benoit Blanc has one more mystery adventure in him, at least one. Just as James Bond always returns, and just as Benoit Blanc will return at least one more time, so too will the James Bond Complex, with whatever is scheduled on the Google calendar for next week. On that note, merci, toujours un plaisir, à la prochaine, and I guess happy 2023.
들어줘서 감사합니다. 안녕히 계세요. 아리가또, 마타네.